A little bit earlier today, I made a recording on the subject of optimism. For some reason, the first 5 minutes were missing. That's what I'm going to supply now, because the rest of the podcast, I think, was okay. So, optimism. Anna actually suggested, as I was departing from the house, that I do a recording on that subject. And I hadn't prepared anything. But recently, a friend had said to me that she had become less optimistic as a result of hearing one of my talks, which kind of slightly surprised me. She thought this was a good thing because she came to the conclusion that she perhaps had a tendency to wear rose-coloured spectacles or to project wish fulfilment fantasies onto the world. Now, I suppose on the plus side, optimism does make us kind of feel better. It's a buoyant feeling. It's an energetic feeling. On the downside, of course, is that it can distort our perception of reality, of brute reality. And I did counsel my friend, not to get too pessimistic, because it's kind of dark and gloomy. It don't feel very nice. And I suppose equally, in some ways, it disguises some of the great and luminous things about being alive. Anyway, she reported that she was kind of a little bit more in the middle, and that it felt like a kind of an equilibrium, which felt good. Anyway, the first thought that I had when I was trying to compose a little talk on optimism on the hoof, as it were, was about Voltaire's novel Candide, which he wrote in the 18th century. Candide it literally means optimism, and it's the name that Voltaire gives to his main character. It's a short book, you can read it in an afternoon, and it's a very, very funny book. Anyway, I'm just going to hand you over now to my outdoor self. Voltaire was also a considerable influence on the Prussian Enlightenment, because he spent some time with King Frederick of Prussia, who was characterised as an enlightened monarch. And Voltaire, for his part, visited England and was kind of quite taken by the creative and energetic vibe of England at the time, where there was a rise of the bourgeoisie and considerable interest in science. I mean, both England and Scotland were really at the forefront of these movements in thought, in science, in technology, in polity, and so forth. Probably as a result of the attenuation of the monarch's powers in the previous century, the end of the previous century, the Glorious Revolution, and so forth. Anyway, for a whole host of reasons and a whole host of conjunctions of circumstances and conditions, there was this pretty kind of sparky movement in the British Isles, and Voltaire was impressed. Anyway, Candide, the book, is the story of a character called Candide, and Candide has various adventures over Europe and in South America, and he's a kind of a wanderer on the planet, and it's a kind of a getting a wisdom novel, I suppose. It's a Bildungsroman. And Candide is the disciple of one Dr. Pangloss, who apparently is modelled on Leibniz, Gottfried Leibniz. And Pangloss had got this doctrine that this is the best of all possible worlds. And this is something that that Leibniz believed that he kind of proved logically or almost mathematically. I mean, Leibniz was now, as a thinker and a mathematician, was now a slouch. And he was an extremely smart man. And he developed the calculus and got into an enormous spat with Isaac Newton about a precedence, who discovered it first, or who had developed it first. And Leibniz had also done sort of work on logic, and I think this possible world's logic was something that he brought forward. And I believe this is you can't kind of think about modal logic without an idea of possible worlds. I mean, in Leibniz's scenario, all truths are necessary, but only in the mind of God, because God kind of sets everything up so that it'll play out. And God has created the best of all possible worlds.
Thank you.
For humans to live in. And obviously, from the human point of view, many truths are contingent, but in the mind of God, they're all necessary, because everything is, as you say, it's set up, and it's set up to be the best. Now, Pangloss, Dr. Pangloss is Leibniz, and Pangloss, interesting word, isn't it? Pan, meaning, as in pantheism, everything or all, and gloss, well, it comes from the word glossary, glossolalia, and so forth. From the same root, and basically, Pangloss means all talk. It's all talk. It's all theory. And what Voltaire is doing in Candide is attempting to debunk Leibnizian optimism, even to the extent of giving the main character the name Optimism. I mean, basically, the story is a series of catastrophes that Candide undergoes, but he remorselessly keeps insisting this is the best of all possible worlds. His optimism is unfeasible, and Voltaire keeps piling on the disaster upon disaster upon disaster. Each page has got a fresh one, and it's hilarious. To be honest, it's hilarious. Voltaire really exploits the humour of this. Finally, at the end of the book, after countless disasters and catastrophes and sufferings and losses and setbacks and pains, Candide, more or less, finally loses his grip on this doctrine. Of this being the best of all possible worlds. Let's go of it. And he then kind of wonders what to do. And in fact, he does this in conjunction with his companions, because all the way through the drama and the adventure, Candide has got companions. And a lover who starts off, Cunegonde, who starts off as the most beautiful creature he's ever seen, and it ends up as a wizened harridan and harpy at the end. So anyway, with his little party of companions, Candide seeks some advice. And actually, he takes some advice from a dervish. They find a wise dervish who seems to have a repose in his soul. That's remarkable, and convinces Candide that he ought to listen to this chap. And the dervish advises Candide and his companions. He says, what you should do is find yourself a piece of land and just dig the garden, tend your garden. And in that, you'll find quietly, over time, and quietly, you'll find some some equanimity and even some happiness. You know, but you won't have rose-coloured spectacles about the nature of reality. Sometimes you'll lose crops. Sometimes you'll do well. Yeah. You will experience grief, etc., etc. And I think the Davies tries to instil some reality. And in the light of that reality, a mode of life suggests itself. And this, of course, it's dig your garden. Yeah, tend your garden. So that's Voltaire's optimism. And as I said, his target is the attempt by Leibniz to give an inviolable optimism, a metaphysical foundation in the ultimate nature of reality and the ultimate nature of God. And this was, in some senses, the first shot in the war against, in the war against metaphysics and grand narratives and ontotheology, you might say, that really characterises the so-called European Enlightenment. And it is a struggle, you know, that doesn't go in a kind of a straight line. Got many twists and turns, and many of the philosophers of the 18th century were particularly atheists, even though there was a move towards deism, which is the idea that God kind of created the universe and put in place the laws of physics, in fact, which will govern the unfolding of events in the universe, and then retired. You know, you kind of set the clockwork going, wound up the clock, and then moved into the background. You know, the God of deism doesn't interfere. But nevertheless, the notion of a first cause wasn't abandoned. I think we see the beginning of the notion of the abandonment of a final cause, particularly, you know, stemming out the work of Galileo and Descartes in the 17th century. And Newton styled himself a deist. And in the 18th century you got the great deist poem of Alexander Pope, which talked about all this stuff in a poetic format. And I mean, Voltaire himself, I mean, sometimes it's kind of fairly difficult to discern his religious outlook, but he certainly was no fan of the Catholic Church, and many of the horrors that Candide undergoes are kind of the result of, like, religious persecution. I mean, Voltaire's phrase was écraser l'infâme. You know, eradicate the infamy, and by which he was talking about the power of the Catholic Church. But, I don't know, some people will tell you that Voltaire was a deist, others that he was an atheist. I mean, another big figure of the European Enlightenment was David Hume. He was at the forefront of the Scottish Enlightenment. And Hume was just an outright atheist. I mean, for which he suffered a certain lack of advancement in Scottish academia. I mean, Hume was in line for the chair of philosophy at Glasgow, which is an extremely venerable university founded in the 13th century. And because he was an atheist, but certainly he was the most able philosopher of the age, and certainly up there with the top few, you might say. And so, I mean, what I'm trying to outline here is, you know, that this European Enlightenment wasn't this kind of linear movement away from faith towards atheism, away from Aristotelianism towards kind of empiricism, and the rise of science and technology on the back of the rise of bourgeois economic activity. In other words, mass production, factory production, eventually the utilisation of steam power, and so on, and the advent of the Industrial Revolution, which of course like peaked in the following century. And as a part of all this, a part of the making space for a mathematical physics, and then a technology on the back of the predictive power of that mathematical physics, and the corollary of that being the rise of bourgeois political power, because it was the bourgeois, it was the new money that was able to mobilise these ideas into money-making stuff. I mean, this canal that I'm walking along here now was built in the back end of the 18th century as a part of the infrastructure of that movement. And so, you know, Voltaire, he took this shot against Leibniz, the ultimate metaphysician. You know, this is the best of all possible worlds and God made it so. And here's the mathematical proof. I mean, there's a certain irony in as much as Leibniz developed the mathematics of the calculus, without which the modern technological world wouldn't have been possible, without that mathematical insight and the way it could be applied to physics and prediction of how things unfold materially in the material world. So a certain irony. And obviously Voltaire was more concerned about the existential impact of these ideas, of this pinnacle of metaphysical certainty. And he was a great artist, Voltaire. And his method is really this raucous humour. Anyway, I recommend that you have a read of Candide if you're an optimistic person. And I suppose being an old hippie and an allotmentist of many decades, that one quite likes the message. Yeah, tend the garden, get on with it, get down into the ordinary, dig down into the ordinary and appreciate it. And I mean, I would take it a bit further and say appreciate it for its beauty and sublimity. I mean, as far as I can see, the great epiphanic experiences promised by yoga and Buddhism and Taoism and Christian contemplation, Sufism and so on, is actually available to us in the ordinary, in the spadeful of soil and in the tending of the garden and so forth. Even though I do understand and realise, you know, that we also like extreme experiences, visionary experience. I mean, I think the ordinary can furnish us with quiet enlightenment, full on but quiet, you know. And we also have available to us visionary experience, maybe psychedelic experience, which is kind of dramatic and symbolic and discombobulating, you know. And these experiences are related. So, I think the dichotomy between the glass half full and the glass half empty is perhaps a little bit overdrawn. And like most binaries, we probably want to find a way of getting from under them as structuring principles of our thought and our understanding and our evaluation and our apprehension of our lives and the world in which those lives play out. And of course, as I mentioned, you know, the danger of optimism is it becomes a denial of the what is, of the isness of what we actually experience. And this, of course, is Voltaire's thing. He's pointing out that, well, if you live through a metaphysical doctrine, you're going to kind of keep bumping against the brute reality, the hardness of the ground, the solidity of the brick wall, that brute facticity, you might call it. And stubborn as you might be in the face of that, you will just keep getting your nose rubbed in it. And it doesn't matter how elegant the metaphysical justification is, it somehow can't get past that brute facticity, that hardness of the road. But why our self-help wallers and improvers of humanity recommend optimism is that it does kind of give you certain energy. And you see that in Candide, you know, he's relentless. He goes off in search of El Dorado, the city of gold. And he denies that having your buttocks cut off is a disaster. And so forth. But he's kind of got it kind of gives him the energy, because he's never discouraged. He's got the energy to keep going. And I think this is what our self-help wallers have discerned. But I would say it's not enough, really, certainly not to convince me to be a remorseless and relentless optimist. But similarly, you know, the recognition is also there that pessimism, it ends up being gloomy, you know, and you think pessimism is what could drive somebody to suicide. And if paralysing as well, it soaks up energy. Thinking the worst all the time just soaks up your energy. And I think actually this pessimism, optimism trope is just worth dropping altogether. But we can ask, you know, what's worth keeping in this? And I think it is the energy of optimism. And it seems to me that in this situation of being alive, having energy is a good thing. If it's all possible, having the energy to go on, having the energy to create things, having the energy to make things, having the energy to interact, having the energy to love wholeheartedly. And this is, I think, William Blake, who's somebody who actually represents a reaction against the optimism of the Enlightenment, because he saw that it had given birth to dark satanic mills. You know, he saw the horror of the work in the mass production system that rose up in the 19th century, out of the scientific and technological breakthroughs of the 18th century, which rose on the back of philosophical breakthroughs of the 17th and 18th century. He saw the horror of that. He called, you know, he spoke about dark satanic mills and the wage slavery that the common people were put under. And Blake talked about energy is eternal delight. Energy is eternal delight. And all of our contemplative, ecstatic, mystical, aesthetic experiences come out of an abundance of energy. Without an abundance of energy, we can't have them. And a pessimism, a full pessimism with its full existential weight, because it saps your energy, doesn't let you experience the delight in living. But this is an energetic crisis. It's not that you're insufficiently optimistic. It's not that you haven't mastered denying the brute facticity of matter and of life as it unfolds. And it's not as though you need to deny
reality in order to adopt rose-coloured spectacles and to metaphysically justify those rose-coloured spectacles in order to have energy. You can actually just have energy. In a way that's independent of that of that binary of glass half full, glass half empty. And I think Blake really hit upon something there. Energy is eternal delight. And there are various ways of realising that, you know, and I suppose we talk about a kind of being easeful with the unfolding of things. Again, not to be confused with optimism, but in itself a way of liberating your life energy for the business of living and for the business of living with a full capacity for aesthetic, mystical experiences of the beautiful, the sublime, and so on. I suppose I would say, you know, the Socratic question, you know, how should life be lived? And I would say ecstatically, I would say with delight, and therefore with energy. But if you purchase that energy with a false optimism, with a denial of the nature of reality, of the type that Candide undertook, you will suffer. You know, it won't mitigate your suffering. It will intensify your suffering. Until in the end, you know, you kind of have to. Well, I don't know. Maybe it is possible to deny till the end of a life. What I keep calling, you know, the brute facticity, or in Buddhist terms, you know, the reality of suffering and vulnerability to suffering. So understand all this, I would say, on the terrain that there are terrain of energy, and there are certain allowing, letting be with bright awareness. Liberates that basic energy, that life energy, and then liberates one into a life of eternal delight, as Blake put it. And that the great thing here is that this is possible without a denial of a clear perception of what's going on around one. Without blinkers and without rose-coloured spectacles. And Voltaire again gives us a little bit of a clue as to where you might find this stuff. And you see, you find it in the ordinary, in the tending of the garden, and in the companionship with other gardeners. Now, I suppose this could be construed as a kind of a passive acceptance of the political status quo. And I'm pretty sure Voltaire wasn't of that ilk. I think he had to leave France because of his political opposition to the absolute monarchy and the resistance of the aristocracy and the powerful in France to the unfolding of the Enlightenment that was going on over the channel in the British Isles. I think that digging the garden, tending the garden, isn't inimical to having a political view and a desire to work for the survival of the human species. Anyway, it's a bit noisy down this end, so I'm going to love you and leave you. Thanks for listening.